Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, I'm not going to sit in front of you and tell you that I haven't been around some bad things. I have. But I can also tell you that these things that you think that I've done, these things that you've heard about me, they are false. Completely false. Now, is there misconduct in this department? Of course there's misconduct, but I'm not the one you want. Can I ask you a question? I'm one of the most talked about, most celebrated officers history of this city. Do you not find it odd? And now all of a sudden I'm the mastermind of this whole thing? That doesn't strike you as weird?
They're all lying.
That's what I said.
That's actor John Bernthal in a scene from the HBO miniseries We Own This City. He plays Sergeant Wayne Jenkins of the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force. The series is based on investigative journalist Justin Fenton's book, We Own This City, a true story of crimes, cops, and corruption. It's the story of the systemic problems in the department that came to light in the wake of the Freddie Gray uprising. The show was created by David Simon and George Pelicanos. David, of course, is the creator of The Wire, a fictional saga addressing some of the same themes in Baltimore. George served as one of Simon's stable of writers for The Wire, often scripting its most heartbreaking episodes. Now they return to Baltimore 20 years later to see what, if anything, has changed. George Pelicanos joins us from his home in Washington, D.C., to talk about the show and why he was interested in adapting the book for television.
Well, we both knew the story of We Own the City, which was about the GTTF, the Gun Trace Task Force. It was a big local story and became a national story. But the first thing that David and I always do is when we're deciding on these things is we sit down and ask each other, what's this about and why are we doing this? Because what is it about modern-day policing? We're really going back to the beginning of the drug war that has facilitated such behavior, in other words, and encouraged such behavior. Because when you make it the mission to mass incarcerate and to mass arrest, you create this atmosphere where police break rules. You know, when I say break rules, I'm talking about unconstitutional policing, illegal stops, illegal search and seizures, because they're in the service of their bosses and the politicians who love to run on law and order and love to run on I'm tough on crime. And that's really what we wanted to talk about, all those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fans of The Wire are going to see a lot of familiar faces and themes in We Own This City, but this is not a coda to The Wire. How did you and David approach returning to Baltimore to tell this story, knowing that a lot of people are probably going to draw comparisons?
This is a different animal in the sense that it's entirely fact-based, and we had to stick to the facts and not veer off into conjecture. And all of the characters, except for one, are based on actual people, and we had to honor that. The Wire was rooted in reality, but it was all fictional characters. But it is, in a sense, a coda, because the Baltimore that we left 15, 20 years ago is different now. The conditions have gotten worse for the citizens. To give you an example, there was a scene in one of the Wire episodes where Herc and Carver find some money during a raid and they shove it in their vests. 20 years later, you've got police officers in reality doing home invasions, robbing citizens, and most importantly, they were confiscating drugs and selling them back out on the street. That would have been unheard of 15, 20 years ago in the police force. So in that sense, it is a coda. It's an update on what's going on in the city and by extension, what's going on in America vis-a-vis the police.
Mm-hmm. You're right, actually. That's a very good point. And it's interesting that some points of the We Own This City timeline intersect with your fictional Baltimore Wire line from The Wire, don't they?
That's true. Yeah, and we go back to the beginning of Wayne Jenkins' career, which was he came out of the academy in 2003, and I believe we started The Wire in 2002, so those timelines do intersect. You know, one of the reasons we went back to the beginning, first of all, he was the longest-serving police officer on the GTTF, and also we wanted to show what happens to a police officer coming out of the academy. You know, the academy tries to teach them right. They teach them constitutional policing. they have sensitivity training. And so in the show, you know, and this really happened. The Jenkins comes out of the academy, and they put him up with a sergeant. And the very first day, the sergeant says to him, "I'm going to show you how to police. This is Baltimore."
What's the charge on that guy?
Loitering in a drug-free zone. Failure to yield, failure to obey.
What's any of that do in court?
Doesn't go to court. Pulls them off the street till they see the court commissioner in the morning, then they drop the charges. Or if the ASA cuts him loose from the jail side, then maybe he's indoors till early morning.
Well, that's a good thing.
That's what they want. Like the LT says, we clear the corners, they'll stop shooting each other. If they stop shooting each other, the murder rate goes down. And if the murder rate goes down, the mayor gets to be the governor.
And so the system sort of sabotaged these guys coming fresh out of the academy. You know, none of these guys, we don't portray them as villains. I mean, when they started out, they wanted to be good police. And the system is what corrupted them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they go from, like, yeah, as you say, Wayne Jenkins was considered a hero by among Baltimore Police Department members, and then he, once this is found out, he ends up becoming corrupted, well, and he becomes an anti-hero. We here at Beta love chameleonic actors, and there are few better than John Bernthal. Besides his impressive Baltimore accent, what made John your choice to play the part of Wayne Jenkins?
Well, David and Nina Noble had worked with him before on the Yonkers show they did. Mm-hmm. And I knew he could play a tough cop. John's from Baltimore, from D.C., actually, like me. So I was a little prejudiced in favor of him for that reason. You know, we always offer the actors a way to consult with various departments, police, fire department, whoever they want. We put them, you know, they can do ride-alongs and so on. But John did everything on his own. When, unbeknownst to us, he contacted the police himself. He got himself embedded with these guys. He went out on raids. He did all kinds of things. Consequently, he would come to set, and we did years of research on this show, and he would come to set knowing things about Jenkins that we didn't know. You know, I would say to him, "Well, John, why do you got to have a lollipop in your mouth during this scene?" You know, and he's like, "Well, Jenkins always liked this specific kind of lollipop." And one day, David, there was a courtroom scene where Jenkins was testifying in the box, and he was wearing his police vest. And David came on set, and he said, "No, you know, a police officer would never wear his vest when he's testifying." And so John Bernthal pulls out a Polaroid picture of Jenkins wearing his vest while testifying.
I wonder about the lollipop. Was that Jenkins channeling Telly Savalas as Kojak, perhaps?
Well, of course, I like to think so. Telly Savalas being one of my personal heroes, you know.
Yeah, I like to think so too. Yeah. How were Jenkins and the Gun Trace Task Force able to get away with stealing from citizens and drug dealers?
What happened after the uprising, the Freddie Gray uprising, was that the officers involved in that, the Freddie Gray death, were over-prosecuted by the state's attorney's office. And by the way, they're still on the force because they were never going to be convicted of what they were charged with. But there was a work slowdown in Baltimore on the police force after that. A lot of cops said, "Look, if I'm gonna get charged because somebody bumps their head while I'm putting them in my car, I'm just not going to get out of my car anymore. I'm not going to make arrests." But the GTTF cops kept working. They kept producing. They kept getting guns off the street. And the brass, up until 2 weeks before they were all arrested, the brass was giving them commendations and singing their praises in the police newsletters. And they were guys who were allowed to keep doing what they were doing because they were producing.
"You're an earner and you work your ass off. We are always going to protect you. But seriously, you could have been nailed. Problem is, you half-assed the paperwork."
"Look, I'll be honest with you. I didn't really think this was much of anything."
"Look here.
You
know? Always start with the attack. The threat to your safety can never be mentioned enough. See, it has to seem standard to anyone looking at this that you and any other officers were in serious danger."
"I know."
Guns in the city are a very important component of controlling violent crime. So they had a big responsibility. And they put the most productive, gung-ho guys on that squad. And that's the kind of guys they put on that squad. There's all kinds of plainclothes squads in the city. Jenkins had worked in many of them, VCID, violent crimes, and he worked with Sean Suter many years before, which is a big part of the storyline in the show, the tragedy of Sean Suter, which we can talk about if you'd like.
Most definitely. That was actually my next question, and you set it up, teed it up very nicely for us. Thank you. Yeah, this Detective Sean Suter storyline, he crossed paths with Jenkins early in their careers, and if you had made up Sean's story, made that arc up for a fiction series or a novel, it would feel too scripted. Can you tell us a little bit about Sean Suter?
Yeah, Sean had come up through the ranks. He was patrol and then plainclothes units, and he eventually became a homicide cop. And by all accounts, he was a good one. And when these guys were arrested, he got called in by the FBI, the task force, and they said, we need you to testify at a grand jury. And although Sean never served on the GTTF and he wasn't with those guys, one of the GTTF guys who knew him back in the day said that Sean Suter took money here and there. So what happened was Sean went in and they told him, you know, you're going to have to testify about what you know from back in the day with Jenkins and that kind of thing. And Sean Suter knew that under oath he would have to tell the truth and that he was going to lose his job because of it. And so the day before his grand jury testimony, he was killed by gunfire in a vacant lot.
Go, go, go!
I didn't see anyone.
The shooter!
I got here so fast, man. I could see the gun smoke above from where he was laying. I didn't see anybody.
But you heard the shots.
I heard three, maybe four shots. One of them might have been an echo. He shouted, "Stop police!" Then the shots. His leg was still moving when I got here, man. I was just coming from the corner. So I was here within 3 to 4 seconds.
Where was the gun?
Under his right shoulder.
I'm hesitant to say anything else about it because there's two schools of thought in Baltimore, and there always will be. Nobody was in that lot. Nobody saw the shooting. It's a more dramatic story to say that he was assassinated before his grand jury testimony. And then there's other people who think that he committed suicide and made it look like a murder because if you do commit suicide, your family doesn't get your pension. Any way you look at it, it was a tragedy because Sean Suter was not in league with these guys. And his death shook the city.
Yeah. Wunmi Musaku plays Nicole Steele, and she's an attorney who works for the Civil Rights Office of the DOJ. It seems to me that she kind of serves as the moral conscience of this series. Can you share the inspiration behind this character?
Yes. Wunmi plays Nicole Steele, who's a composite character of the Civil Rights Division of the DOJ, those people who came to town and wrote a report and then a consent decree. And the reason we whittled it down to one character is we wanted to have somebody who would be the eyes for the audience. In other words, somebody who's coming into Baltimore with fresh eyes and seeing all this stuff as the audience is seeing it. And Wunmi was a good choice. You might not know this, but she's British. She has a very heavy British accent. And you wouldn't know it from watching the show. And her role was difficult in that, you know, some of the hardest acting parts are the ones that are not showy. A lot of her scenes are just listening to people. And it really wasn't until we got into the editing room that I saw how good she was, because that's tough to convey, you know, emotion just by listening and things of that nature. It's in her eyes, and she's a very good actress.
Yeah, very good indeed, and excellent. Excellent choice. You mentioned just a second ago a consent decree, and that comes up a lot, this idea of a consent decree throughout the series. Can you explain what a consent decree is?
Well, it's basically when the feds come in to town and they hold the city's feet to the fire in terms of reform, things like body cameras and that sort of thing. What they have as their ace card is withholding federal funds to the city if the city doesn't comply. For the most part, the police brass welcome it because it kind of takes the pressure off of them to do the things that need to be done. The problem is that the consent decrees can't go far enough. And the reason that they can't is they don't change the mission. And that's the problem, is the mission is flawed. And it's the thesis of the show.
You're asking me what happens if the police don't want to change?
No, I'm saying that we are the people the police department hunts and kills and captures. And you are bringing me a piece of paper that says there's going to be new rules on how they can hunt us?
the drug war has not just destroyed neighborhoods and individuals and families, but it's ruined policing. Police can't operate effectively to get violent criminals off the street when citizens won't talk to them anymore. And the reason they won't talk to them is they've had brothers and sisters and fathers and uncles and cousins who've all gone to jail for nonviolent drug offenses, and they've stopped talking to the police. So the show is really our continuing argument. It's the last nail in the coffin for the drug war.
Yeah. Baltimore has averaged more than 300 murders a year since 2015, and the city is one of the most violent major cities in the U.S. What do you think could be done to change this?
There's always going to be violence in cities. I'm in D.C. We've got a spike right now in violent crimes and carjackings and that kind of thing. There's a lot of reasons for that. In Baltimore, which is something we talked about going back to The Wire, is that the end of working class jobs has cast a shadow over the whole city. If people live in poverty and have no chance to pull themselves up, there's going to be crime. Until that's addressed, there's always going to be problems. You know, when we went back to shoot this and we shot in some of the same neighborhoods we shot in 20 years ago, it was really distressing to see that the physical neighborhoods, the blocks hadn't changed. The same plywood was in the windows of those same houses. And when you see that graphically like that, you sort of understand that why the situation not only has not really changed, it's gotten worse. On the other hand, we really love the people that we meet in Baltimore. They come out of their houses and talk to us while we're shooting. We listen, we have a good dialogue, and they love their hometown. So I don't want to make it sound like there's no hope. There's always hope, and the people are going to be the ones that bring it around.
Mm. Yeah, and as you mentioned earlier, the people not talking to the police, that would hopefully change, and that might...
It's a big one.
That's a huge one that would help make things better. George Pelikanos, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations to you, David Simon, and everyone else who worked on We Own This City. It's a really powerful, great, important miniseries.
Great to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
George Pelikanos is the co-executive producer of the HBO miniseries We Own This City. You can find out more about George and We Own This City at wpr.org/beta.
I was so afraid of being stereotyped, and I really had like a chip on my shoulder to say, you know, I don't limit me. I can write about whatever I want.
Coming up, novelist Elaine Shea Chao on her debut novel, Disorientation. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.